Thank you, Jared. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Really is it's gratifying to see so many folks here. I should mention my wife. She's the one who noticed it was during spring break. And so I said, Rob, you better contact her and find out. Okay, I will. So she's ultimately responsible for this good turnout. So thanks for Debbie. Great. So this is a talk based on some work I've done, mostly as a teacher at UT. I've taught a course on philosophy and Tolkien there, I think, 6 or 7 times. And it's been a pretty popular course, goes pretty well. And so it's just kind of distilling that whole semester down to a few crucial points here. So I'm going to look at how my own work, as Jared sort of suggested, is in metaphysics, so a theory about the world and how it all fits together. So I'm going to approach Tolkien mostly from that perspective. I know some people approach the philosophy of Tolkien more from a point of view of ethics or political philosophy and so on, but my own bias is sort of metaphysics, so I'm going to focus on that instead. And how Middle-earth shaped the postmodern world. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how I think why Tolkien's so significant, actually, even beyond the world of literature, ultimately. So here's a little overview of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to mention 5 theses about how philosophy and Tolkien are related to each other. Then, of course, talk about what Tolkien's philosophy is. And then I'm going to focus on this group called the Inklings that you may know about, a group of friends in Oxford that included Tolkien and Lewis and others. I'm going to focus on a particular one of them called Owen Barfield, who was a philosophical linguist that had a big impact on Tolkien. And then finally, close with some thoughts about what I call the uncanny influence of Tolkien's work, how he's been much more influential than we might think. So let's get into the 5 theses. Of these 5, I think 2 are sort of boring. That is, they apply to lots of people, and then the others get a little more interesting as you go on. So if you're bored at the beginning, don't worry. They get more interesting. So first of all, Tolkien has some theological and philosophical views that influenced his work. I think there's no question about that, right? And so that's true of an awful lot of writers, maybe all writers, ultimately. But I still want to start with that. But then I think we can also say, this is a bit more controversial, actually, that Tolkien saw his fiction in part as a vehicle for propagating those views. I'll try to explain what I mean by that exactly. But even this is not a universal feature, I think, of writers, but it's still pretty common. You can point to lots of authors, C.S. Lewis himself. We could talk about Aldous Huxley, Orwell, Philip Pullman, Ayn Rand, lots of people that have used their literature to propagate their views. So Tolkien's, I think, in that camp. Then they get a little more interesting. So I'm going to argue that Tolkien's fiction was what I call an embodiment or an incarnation of his philosophy. So it's not that philosophy just sort of appears in the stories in a kind of extraneous way, but it's woven into the stories and the characters themselves in a sort of very deep way that's implicit in some cases. And then fourthly, that philosophy, the same one that's incorporated into Tolkien's work, also guided the construction of his work. So there's a philosophical element to his method of writing the Lord of the Rings. And then finally, I'm going to argue that to explain his success as an author, we have to look at the philosophical substance of his work. So the fact that philosophy is involved here is actually important in explaining why it's had the kind of impact that it's had. That's the claim I'm going to make anyway. So first of all, let's talk about what Tolkien's philosophy was before we get into the argument for those theses in detail. I got a little bit ahead of myself. So let me go back, actually, over this a bit. Let me say a little bit more about 3, 4, and 5 before I move on. So on 3, Tolkien's fiction was the embodiment or the incarnation of his philosophy. This, I think, is relatively rare. I think the best parallel is actually Plato, philosopher, who, if you read his philosophical work, he will have dialogue in which they're presenting philosophical ideas, and then there are stories or myths that are interspersed through the dialogues as well. And Plato was really a master at weaving together fiction and philosophy in this way. But I think Tolkien's another master of that sort. Fourthly, the idea that philosophy guided Tolkien's construction of Tolkien's work. I think that's unique, actually. I don't know of any other major literary writer, where philosophy itself played a role in the construction of their works. And I'll try to explain why I believe that's true. And then the fifth thing, yeah. So on the success as an author, I want to say a little bit about that too. That as you know, Lord of the Rings has had a huge impact. They've done a lot of polls in which they asked what people's favorite book was, favorite work of literature in the 20th century, and Tolkien is one that those polls over and over again. So in almost every case, The Lord of the Rings ends up being the favorite work of the 20th century. So I think is just the tip of the iceberg, though, the popularity. There's more going on here even than that. Okay, so what was Tolkien's philosophy? I think we could describe it as a sort of Christianized Aristotelian Neoplatonism, right? So we can start with Plato and the Neoplatonists, throw in Aristotle, but then baptize or Christianize the whole thing, and then you end up with something that sort of represents its philosophy. It's sometimes called the perennial philosophy. It's a kind of philosophy that really dominated the Western world in late antiquity, right through the Middle Ages, right up until the 16th, 17th century, something like that. So it's not a profoundly unusual kind of philosophy, but nonetheless, at the time in which Tolkien is writing, in the mid 20th century, this was not the dominant kind of philosophy at all. This was very much a niche kind of philosophy, a minority viewpoint at that time. So of course, it starts with Plato and Aristotle, as almost everything does in philosophy, but then it goes on to include some other key figures, like Plotinus, he's usually described as the father of Neoplatonism, and he's in the 3rd century AD. He's going to be very important here in a minute. He had a lot of influence on Augustine, who was an important Christian thinker of the 4th century. And then there's a philosopher named Boethius, you may have heard of, wrote a book called The Constellation of Philosophy. He was a Roman senator and philosopher of the 5th and 6th centuries, and a fellow named Pseudo-Dionysius. Well, he was actually, we don't know his name, but he wrote under the name Dionysius, which is a character, a figure that's mentioned in the book of Acts, that it was one of Apostle Paul's converts in Athens when he was talking to the philosophers. And so this 5th century Christian thinker adopted that name and incorporated the work of Plato and Aristotle, as these other people did, into his philosophy. And then Thomas Aquinas, of course, very importantly, 13th century philosopher, theologian, who pulled together this whole tradition and encapsulated it into a number of important works, including the Summa Theologiae. And these had profound influence on Tolkien. No question that there's a Thomistic theme that runs through all of this. So let me talk about some of the things that Tolkien derives from this philosophical tradition. I'll pick up 4 or 5 sort of important themes. One is the idea that all being as being is good. So just to be is good, right? And the more you are, the better. So being and goodness are convertible, is the idea. This is a real important idea that comes actually from Plotinus, this non-Christian, even pagan philosopher, who influenced Augustine, because before Augustine's conversion, he believed that there were two substances in the world, evil and good, and they were sort of equal and opposite forces that were battling with each other. And from Plotinus, he learned that was wrong, that actually goodness is inherent in all existence, right? And so being, so evil, badness, is always a lack of being. It's a privation. It means that something's been deprived of its full existence, right? And one of the consequences of that is that absolute evil is impossible, right? Because in order to be at all, you've got to be good to some extent. So even the devil, right, is good to some extent, because if he weren't, he wouldn't exist at all, right? Whereas absolute good is possible, because that's just something that exists in the fullest possible way, and that's God. And you find this sort of idea in the Lord of the Rings throughout it, really. So if you think about the ring race, for instance, right, they were originally human beings, right, and now they're these evil creatures, right? But what's happened to them is a matter of loss. So they've lost their own minds. They're not only invisible, they're also blind. They've lost their own capacity for feeling and imagination. they have a more and more tenuous grip on existence, right? They're almost non-existent altogether, right? And that corresponds closely in Tolkien's picture with the idea that there's something wrong with them. And also the word wraith itself, it comes from the same word in English that we get wreath from. So it has this idea of being twisted. So twisting is another thing that's often associated with evil in this tradition. So again, evil's not some new kind of entity or new sort of force. It's rather taking something that's good and twisting it, right? Distorting it in some ways. And so that's what's happened to the wraiths in the story. Another theme that relates to this is the idea of harmony versus disharmony. So harmony is a kind of existing, right, where things are working together. Disharmony is just the lack of harmony, right? And so, again, disharmony is bad because it's the lack of harmony, which is full existence. And you find this running through the works very, very consistently, right? The good are part of a fellowship. Fellowship of the Ring, the beginning, right? They generally are able to pull together and work together and cooperate. The evil in the books are always at odds with each other, right? You have Saruman and Sauron, who are working both evil, but they're working against each other. And even within Sauron's empire, right, the various orcs are often in conflict with each other, right? They can't cooperate fully because they're disunited. They're not united by a common sort of being, right? Another sort of issue that's very important in the Platonic tradition is this idea of participation or imitation. So the thought is that, in Plato's theory, there's these things called the forms, right, which are sort of heavenly archetypes, right, that are ultimately responsible for things in our world being the way they are. So there's beautiful things in our world. How do we explain that? There's the beauty itself, which is this form in Plato's heaven. And beautiful things become beautiful by participating in that paradigm, in that archetype of beauty. Justice, something's just by virtue of imitating the form of justice, or the tables are all imitations of the form of table, right, and so on. And so this idea of imitation, or sometimes it's also called participation, the individual things participate in a common form. That's an idea that runs through Tolkien's works very, very consistently. So you'll know, for instance, that the phial of Galadriel, a little phial with a light in it that Frodo uses, the light in that phial comes from the Star of Arendelle, right, who was a character from the Silmarillion, right? And that light of his star comes from the Silmarils, one of the Silmarils. And that the light from the Silmarils comes from one of the two trees, right, which are the original sources of light in the universe in his picture. So there's a sense of the source, right, being higher and greater than the effect, the thing that depends upon. So there's a series of steps of imitation or participation in Tolkien's work. And there's a sense in which you're diminished at each stage, right? You're not quite as, the phial of Galadriel is not really as bright as the original Silmaril was or the tree was in the original situation. But still, it still has some power by virtue of that participation, right? Now another key idea is the idea of providence. And this comes primarily, I guess, from the Christian influence on this tradition. So Christian Platonists and others certainly had the view that our world is governed somehow by divine providence. There's a divine plan that's using good and evil to shape our ends, as Hamlet puts it, right? Even though we rough-hew them ourselves. And so there's a lot of examples of this. When Gandalf is talking to Frodo during the quest, he says, behind Gollum, there was something else at work beyond any design of the ringmaker. I can put it no plainer than by saying that Bilbo was meant to find the ring and not by its maker, in which case you were also meant to have it. And that may be an encouraging thought. And so, you know, Tolkien doesn't tell us who meant this, right? But obviously we're supposed to infer that there's some kind of power beyond Sauron and beyond the other characters who has proposed this. Elrond's pretty explicit about this too at the council, right? He says, he tells the people at the council of Elrond that or Rivendell, that they've been called there. He said, called, I say, although I have not called you to me, strangers from distant lands, you have come and are here and met in this very nick of time, by chance as it may seem, yet it is not so. Believe rather that it is so ordered that we who sit here and none others must now find counsel for the peril of the world. So again, he's saying that there's something else that's ordered them to come together in this way in order to produce this. And so this providence, the fact that this providence is at work in the world, is what enables us to have a happy ending of the story. And that's really important for Tolkien. In his essay on a fairy tale, he says that the happy ending, you know, what he calls the EU catastrophe. So you know what a catastrophe is. And EU means good. So it's the really, really good catastrophe, the thing that completely overturns everything you've expected up to that point in a good way. That, of course, we find at the very end of the Lord of the Rings. And that's a reflection of this idea of providence. Now, the other thing that's important here in connection with providence is the idea that it uses imperfect human beings and even evil for its own purposes. Right? So the example of the cooperation between divine providence and human freedom is really a theme that's there in the book. So, for instance, think of the many times in which people show mercy to Gollum. It's really a miserable sort of creature, right? So he's spared by Bilbo first, and then later by Faramir, by Frodo, by Sam, by the woodland elves. So over and over again, people have opportunities to destroy him, and they refuse to do so. Sam's a really interesting case, I think, where, on Mount Doom, Sam's about to kill Gollum and has every reason, every justification, really, to do so. And he says it would have been just to slay this treacherous, murderous creature. But deep in his heart, there was something that restrained him. He could not strike this thing lying in the dust, forlorn, ruinous, and utterly wretched. And it's a choice that Sam makes. But obviously, he's meant to make this choice, right? Because if he killed Gollum, then you wouldn't have had the eucatastrophe at the end. You wouldn't have been able to destroy the ring. And evil, in one of his letters, Tolkien writes, actually wrote this letter in 1944, so right in the middle of World War II. He said, evil works in vain, preparing always only the soil for unexpected good to sprout in. So that, I think that's a thing that you can see happening quite often. So Boromir, in an act of betrayal, right, tries to steal the ring from Frodo. And by doing so, he breaks up the fellowship, right, which enables Frodo and Sam to go off on their own, which they really need to do, and sends the rest of the fellowship off to help Gondor, as they needed to do as well. Or later on, when Gollum betrays Frodo and Sam to Shelob and sends them into the tunnel so they're eaten by the spider, the only way they could have possibly gotten through that pass was through that tunnel, right? So despite the fact that Gollum's intentions were bad, the providence was overriding them and using them for the purpose of good. Or even the case of Sauron himself, right? He musters all of his forces to destroy the Gondorians, and by doing so, he leaves Mordor empty and creates the possibility for Sam and Frodo to get to the crack of doom, and so on. Okay, so anyway, those are some of the Neoplatonic themes that you find in the Tolkien, in the Lord of the Rings. Okay, I just talked about that. So let me talk about the Inklings for a little bit. So Tolkien, you may know, he was working on this sort of thing already as a very young man. Even in the trenches of World War I, he was inventing these Elvish languages and describing, you know, the details of Middle Earth. And throughout his whole life, he was just sort of obsessed with this stuff. But he thought that no one else would ever be interested in this. It was just this weird hobby that he had, right, of creating languages and inventing peoples and so on. But then when he fell into this fellowship with C.S. Lewis and Barfield and others, it was really they that were responsible for saying, no, this is great stuff. You need to write this up and publish it. You need to get this out to the public. And I think Tolkien wouldn't have done that had he not been part of that group. So that fellowship itself, the Fellowship of the Ring, so to speak, is already there at Oxford. So I just mentioned a few of these folks. Probably most important of the group from that personal point of view is C.S. Lewis, who really was the one who kept bugging Tolkien, get to work on that, get that next chapter done, and gave him lots and lots of encouragement as he gave him copies of it. There was Charles Williams, this is a friend of Lewis's, who wrote some really interesting novels, actually, you haven't read. I mean, if you like Tolkien, you might be interested in Williams. They're very different in the sense they're set in the modern world, but their modern world is penetrated by these weird supernatural forces, and so it's some pretty interesting stuff. You may have heard of Austin Farrer, an important theologian of the time. I like his work actually quite a bit. And there was Don B. Griffiths. He became a Dominican monk, and then eventually went to India and became sort of an Indian Swami as well. Simultaneously, he was also part of this group. Dorothy Sayers, the mystery novelist, she was loosely part of the group, I think, as well. And then finally, last but not least, it's Owen Barfield. He and Tolkien and Lewis actually were sort of part of the original circle that grew into the Inklings. And he was this very unique philosopher of language. And all of the Inklings, I think, were united in a sort of common quest, which was nothing short of this, the destruction of scientific materialism is the dominant way of thinking, right? And at the time, it seemed a completely quixotic thing to try to do, because if you know anything about the mid-20th century, especially in England, the English-speaking world, I mean, it was a period where scientific materialism, scientism, was overwhelmingly the dominant way of thinking about things. And to try to dredge up Plato and Aristotle and Aquinas and all this other stuff at that time seemed hopeless. But the group of them thought, no, we can actually do it. At least we can try. And I think it's really remarkable how successful they were. I mean, we live in a very different world now than what they lived in. And to some extent, it's because of their work that we do, I think, ultimately. So Tolkien was really encouraged to make his fiction public, to keep working on it, because the others saw this as an essential part of this project, right, of defeating that kind of materialism. So I want to be careful, though, to make sure that I'm not misconstruing or misrepresenting Tolkien, because if we brought Tolkien back here and said, yeah, you're using your books to propagate a particular philosophy, he would have said, no, that's not right at all. I'm an artist, right? I'm doing this for the sake of the art. And that's true, right? So, but in his case, so I think I'll try to argue, I'm not claiming that he sort of prostituted his art in order to promote a particular political or philosophical end, right? But in this case, in Tolkien's case, the philosophy that we're talking about is incorporated into the story and the characters and the world itself, right? So by being faithful to his vision of this world and being the kind of artist that he was propagating this philosophy as well, right? Not as an extraneous end, but just in the very act of being creative in this way. And so, and the others, I think, encouraged him to say, yes, that's important, keep doing it, right?